I've just mentioned that we were getting VHF signals, and we added a VHF capability towards the end of the 1970s. We first used this to pick up the APT, automatic picture transmissions, from weather satellites of the Tyros, the ESA, the early NOAA series, and the Meteor series. We did produce crude cloud cover pictures on a couple of occasions, but as other people were doing the job far better than we decided not to compete and to stay top of the little league instead of trying to win the top division. However, having the VHF capability did enable us to listen to navigation satellites, and when Chris Wood came back from Fiji, not wanting him to duplicate what we were doing in the United Kingdom, I suggested that he looked for the frequencies of the Russian navigation satellites. And when he found these on frequencies close to 150 megahertz, the frequency used by the American transit satellites, he realised that they were transmitting standard time transmissions correlated with Moscow standard time. By this time, we'd finished with the pen recorder on the China 2 satellite, and so I took the pen recorder to him, and he made a series of chart recordings of the transmissions, which turned out to be 50 bits a second. And over a period of 3 or 4 years between us, he and I were able to decode the actual transmission. This transmission lasts for 2 minutes a frame. With 50 bits a second, that gives us 6,000 bits of information. This was able to show that the first 2 seconds of each minute were blank, then followed 56 seconds comprising 8 blocks of 7 seconds each, and 2 more blank lines at the end of the minute. The first 4 blocks in each minute consisted of blocks A, B, A, B, which were replaced at 3 minute intervals by blocks B, C, B, C, and C, D, C, D, and so on. These blocks contained the satellite's position, or ephemeris. It had X, Y, and Z, distances from the Earth's centre measured in kilometres, X dot, Y dot, Z dot, the rate of change of X, Y, and Z, or the velocities in the X, Y, and Z directions in kilometres per second, and the actual epoch time. The 4 blocks in the second half of the minute were parameter blocks, and these contained the information about all the active satellites in the Russian system. In those days, they used to update the system on a Friday night, so all we had to do was to tune in on a Saturday morning, read out the code, and work out which Russian satellites were actually active. This was published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. The Russians call their navigation satellite system Cicada, probably because it chirps on high like an insect. A navigation satellite transmission at real speed. We'll now play it at a quarter speed, and you can hear the distinct pulse every 4 seconds, which corresponds to a second of real time, and the 3 tones which are used.
Jeff, I understand you also received transmissions from the first Chinese satellite.
1970, one Saturday afternoon, the telephone went about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and a voice said, "Do you want to know about this Chinese satellite?" And I thought, "Hello, there's somebody pulling my leg, it's one of my bright lads." I said, "Who is that?" He said, "Oh, it's Dick Pankhurst from the Evening Telegraph, the same man you remember who phoned me about the Voskhod." I said, "Oh yes, Dick." He said, "Well," he said, "it's playing music." I said, "Go on, tell me more." He said, "Well, they've got a frequency here." He told me the frequency. I said, "Well, I'll ring you back." Now, one could expect to perhaps wait 6 or 7 hours before picking up signals from a satellite. If, with one's usual luck, it was around the other side of the world when you started. So I got some books together to do some work. I got my wife to pack me up some food to eat. Set off up to school. By the time I got there, Derek Slater had come across. He said, "I've just had a phone call from the London Evening Standard saying that there's a Chinese satellite up." I said, "Yes, there is, I know. I've got the frequency." He said, "Well, I'd better get that other receiver down from the roof." We'd got an Edison 770R up on the roof for another job. And by the time he came back, I'd picked up these signals playing this tune. Tune went on and on for a month, and we were very glad when the batteries ran out at the end of that time, because it got a bit boring. Of course, everybody said it was a propaganda ploy. Tung Fang Hung, the East is Red. All right, 40 seconds of it was Tung Fang Hung. But then there was the 5 second gap, followed by the 10 seconds of squeaky sounds. And those squeaky sounds were obviously scientific telemetry. Because we were the first people in Europe to pick up these signals, we achieved a certain amount of notoriety, having our signals played on both the BBC and the Independent Television News, and we received an invitation from the Institute of Physics to attend their annual soiree and dinner at the Savoy Hotel in London. So we accepted, and I decided that there'd be an awful lot of bright people there, and one of the questions was going to be, what does it mean? So for a sixth form practical that week, we started to measure the frequencies of the notes in the tune. We measured these with Lissajous figures and an ordinary oscillator, and it became pretty apparent that the key to the scientific telemetry lay actually in the tune. The frequency of the highest note in the tune was the equivalent to the 100% value. The frequency of the lowest note in the tune was equivalent to 0%, and what is more, the length of one telemetry channel was the duration of one crotchet or one black note. So we were rather pleased with ourselves. We hired our suits from Moss Bros, and we went to the Savoy Hotel to meet the President of the Royal Society and all the other learned people. The following year, we had another occasion with China 2, when we again tuned out interference which sounded like horses' hooves. Click, that again turned out to be the telemetry, and this time it was a different kind of telemetry. This was pulse position modulation. There is a saying that the Chinese are exceedingly clever people. They are indeed. Instead of transmitting the whole pulse or the whole of the soccer goalpost as in the PDM, they realised that you could define a value by just transmitting the uprights. So one of the pulses marked the start of the word, the next pulse marked the end of the word. And in this way, we were able to see, later, the change in the telemetry as the satellite moved in and out of the Earth's shadow. It was quite abrupt when it went into the Earth's shadow, less abrupt when it came out. In fact, the telemetry didn't change back until the satellite had been fairly long out of the Earth's shadow. The first occasion that we noticed it, it had been 20 minutes after emerging from the Earth's shadow, which coincided exactly with the length of time that it had been in the Earth's shadow. So we reasoned that the first change in telemetry was when some optical sensor sensed that the satellite had gone into shade, realised that it would get cold and had closed an active thermal control system like a louvre system. Then when it has been in the shadow and comes out, it immediately realises that it's back in the light. One word changes, but of course in that 20 minutes it's cooled down, and it takes another 20 minutes for it to warm up again before the others start to slowly open. So by just listening to the change in this click pattern, or putting it onto a pen recorder, we were able to see really the satellite's louvres opening and closing for their active thermal control system. This year, in 1986, we were awaiting the launch of a Chinese satellite in October for Earth Resources. They'd launched one the previous October, and we'd understood that they were going to do another launch this year. So I determined that we would try and pick up the satellite on one of the first passes over Europe. I did some calculations and realised that all I needed to do was to listen for a period of 2 hours between 7 and 9 in the morning, and I stood a very fair chance of picking it up on the first time round. Well, I started on a Saturday and heard nothing, and on the Sunday I heard nothing. On the Monday I actually lay in bed reading the newspaper, so I didn't start monitoring until just after 8, and about 9:30 the receiver noise quietened and I picked up the signals from China 19. This was good enough for me to telephone Independent Television News in London. They have a teletext service called Oracle, and at 10:10 in the morning, before the satellite had made 2 complete revolutions, we had an ITN exclusive saying the Chinese have launched their 19th satellite according to signals received in Kettering by ITN space consultant Jeff Perry. We went on to say that it was an Earth Resources mission which we recovered after 5 or 6 days, and also added that a Cosmos satellite had just been recovered after setting a duration record for over 200 days.
You also received telemetry signals from the Soyuz manned spacecraft.
You can always tell a Soyuz signal by the fact that the 7th and 8th words are short. Count.
Count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Able to show that these indicate the state of pressure in the command module and the orbital module. In the preparation for the Apollo-Soyuz flight, where the pressures had to be equalised, the Soyuz had to lower its pressure, and during the flight these short pulses both increased to a medium length. Also, in Soyuz recoveries, the pressure in the orbital module is reduced to vacuum, while the pressure in the command module remains at atmospheric pressure. So we see that word 7 stays short, but word 8 goes very long. So we can always tell when a Soyuz is about to be recovered. We were able to show also that the word following these short pulses indicated the cosmonaut who was actually being monitored for respiration rate. Until the flight of Soyuz 4 and 5, this pulse was always of a medium length, but then we only had one cosmonaut in Soyuz 3. We only had one cosmonaut in Soyuz 4 to begin with, but when Soyuz 5 was launched it had 3 cosmonauts, and that word indicated short, medium and long modes. Then we noticed that we were getting short, medium and long modes in the Soyuz 4 telemetry. The only explanation into this could be the fact that 2 cosmonauts had moved from Soyuz 5 to Soyuz 4, which is in fact what had happened. So the biomedical subcommutation that we were observing was able to show us that cosmonauts had transferred from one spacecraft to the other. Before this, we'd been picking up voices from Russian cosmonauts. The first really successful transmission we received came from the first woman in orbit, Valentina Tereshkova, in 1963. We tried for the first two or three days to pick up signals, but had no luck. And then when the signal voice did come through, from first of all Bykovsky and then Tereshkova, the tape recorder wasn't switched on. And being a tape recorder with valves, it took some time to warm up, so all we got were the two words at the end where Tereshkova acknowledged receipt of the signal. Chaika, prayom, meaning seagull, acknowledged.
I understand you also have other voice transmissions from space.
You can also use the VHF to pick up the transmissions from the University of Surrey's amateur satellite. This is an interesting one. It has a digitalker on board. A good British satellite with an American accent.
51, 0, 9, 0, 57, 9, 53, 0, 8, 9, 54, 9, 3, 4, 2, 57, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1, 6, 59, 4, 5, 8, 58, 4, 1,
And then, of course, there's the voice transmissions from the Russian cosmonauts and the American astronauts. These transmissions can be received in the 140 megahertz band for the Russians and the 230 megahertz bands from the shuttle. What we use today are little scanning receivers called AOR-2001s, although I understand that the 2002 is a much better job, but that costs certainly almost twice the price. This is a recording of Svetlana Savitskaya, the second Russian woman to go into space, the first woman to do a spacewalk, removing her spacesuit at the end of that spacewalk. The Russian for spacesuit is Skafandra, and she's wearing spacesuit number 2, Skafandra 02.
Скафандрах 02. 430 ПМВ.
Сколько?
430, 440 ПМВ. Скафандрах 017. ПМВ 450.
This is the voice of American astronaut Owen Garriott from STS-9 when he was flying across Scotland from Glasgow to Edinburgh. He didn't keep to his transmission schedule, and consequently the first person to pick him up was an Irish station. And here's Garriott calling the Irish station, acknowledging his call and telling him that he will play his recording when he gets back on Earth and send him his QSL card.
Yes, Irish station, this is W5 Lima Foxtrot Lima in the spacecraft Columbia. I just came on the air and heard you calling me. I just came on the air at this moment in W5 Lima Foxtrot Lima in the spacecraft Columbia. I heard your call right off, and I'll have it on my tape recorder and get it reported properly when I get back on the ground. So this is W5 Lima Foxtrot Lima, spacecraft Columbia, calling CQ Ireland, Great Britain and Europe. Calling CQ Ireland, Great Britain and Europe. This is W5 LFL in the spacecraft Columbia. Standing by for your calls for the next minute and 10 seconds, over.
In 1977, there was great concern about a decaying satellite carrying a nuclear power source. What was your involvement in this?
Since 1974, we've been fortunate enough to receive from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland two line orbital elements. These are collections of figures specifying the positions of all satellites and pieces of debris in orbit. And these come on a two-day basis now by airmail. And I realised that one couldn't possibly attempt to analyse everything that was in orbit, but there was more data there than we would use for the satellites which were transmitting. So I decided to allocate certain subsets of the Cosmos programme of satellites and of the Molniya satellites Du Bois in the tracking group and let them collect the element sets and analyse them by plotting different graphs. It wasn't long after we started this that Philip Perkins was able to show that the Molniya communication satellites operated in four discrete planes separated at 90 degree intervals, providing global coverage, and was able to tell when a new Molniya satellite was launched which satellite it was replacing. Other lads identified the small manoeuvres due to the microthrusters on Cosmos 699, one of the Russian EOSATs, or Electronic Ocean Surveillance Satellites. After this came the RORSATs, the Cosmoses with the nuclear reactors, which tended to operate in pairs, and they could see to be moving in sympathy. When one raised its orbital period, the other moved its orbital period in order to maintain station keeping. At the end of its operation, the satellite would move to a higher orbit with a period of about 105 minutes, and at that height the nuclear reactor was relatively safe for about 600 years, by which time the radioactivity would have decayed somewhat and it would be possible to have gone and recovered it and brought it safely back to Earth. In 1977, a 13-year-old lad took over a project belonging to two of the older boys. After Cosmos 952 had moved to the higher orbit, I suggested that he looked at 954 until it too moved to the higher orbit. After about a week, at the beginning of November, he came to me and said, "Please, sir, my satellite's not manoeuvring anymore." So I patted him on the head and said, "Don't worry, son, they'll soon raise it to the high orbit." He went away. He waited another week and he came back looking very worried and said, "You know, sir, it's not moving." So I said, "Well, I'd better come and check your figures, hadn't I?" And I checked his figures and he was absolutely right. This thing had stopped making the micro manoeuvres, it was slowly decaying, and here was a satellite with a nuclear reactor coming back to Earth. We didn't do much about it. We were mildly interested. We realised that it was going to be a good visual object. It would make a good project watching it slowly decay. The Royal Aircraft Establishment realised that it would give them a chance, perhaps, to make observations of a satellite going through 16th order resonance, a thing which happens very, very quickly in the usual cases. But on the 6th of January, before it reached 16th order resonance, to quote the Russian announcement, something catastrophic happened when it was out of range of the Soviet Union and it lost attitude stability and began to tumble. And as people in Perth know, when things like Skylab tumble, they tend to come down erratically. And this thing accelerated down and burned up early in 1978, whereas we'd expected it to last until the end of March. I remember teaching that afternoon and the phone call going, and it was a reporter from UPI, United Press International, saying, "Do you know anything about this satellite that's come down over Canada?" I said, "Do you mean Cosmos 954? "Yes," he said. "How did you know?" I said, "Well, we didn't know, but we were expecting it down tomorrow." "You're expecting it down tomorrow," he said. I said, "Oh, yes, yes." I said, "It went wrong back in November." "Good God," he said, "Mr. Trudeau didn't know until this morning." Now, I don't know that I really believe it, but it makes a nice story. We had another one in 1983 with Cosmos 1402. The Russians had redesigned the system. They'd lodged a paper at the United Nations explaining how they'd arranged that with aerodynamic wind tunnel tests that this satellite would actually vaporise in the atmosphere. But we discovered when we got our two-line orbital elements that the satellite had split into three pieces, but none of them had moved to the high orbit. Here we had Cosmos 954 all over again. A little later, a Russian went on television and said they'd actually separated the enriched uranium-235 fuel core from the reactor, and this explained what the actual pieces were. I realised then that we were concentrating on the wrong piece. We were concentrating on piece A. We should really be looking at piece C. We announced this, and people eventually came to believe us, and actually in the period of the 5 weeks that went on for these two pieces to burn up, we had over 900 phone calls in and out of Kettering.
Jeff, how has your family coped with your activities?
Yes, without total support from my family, I don't think I could have done this. My wife is very patient and long-suffering. She's a very good entertainer. She's a good organiser of telephone calls when reporters phone. She even processes the two lines for me now. She's got a menu of satellites, somewhere over 100, and she goes through the two-line orbital elements before I get them, putting ticks against the ones in which I'm interested, and then I actually do the processing. The other day we worked out how much time we spent on this. We had a week's data for 7 days arrived in the same post, and it took her nearly 2 hours to go through and mark the guards. It then took me 4 hours to cut these element sets out using a pair of scissors and arrange them in order on my desk, and a further 4 hours to stick these things onto the data sheets, job which the boys used to do for me. Of course, when I retired from the school, the satellite work there ceased, and nothing else continues there now. As for my daughter, she has tracked satellites ever she can remember. In 1971, United Kingdom launched its one and only satellite with its one and only rocket from the Woomera rocket range. This was Prospero, launched on a Black Arrow. And we thought that Britannia rules the waves, we'd better listen to this, and we went to the school and pointed the six-element crossed Yagi antenna in the direction from which the satellite would come, tuned in the Edison 770R, and picked up a signal going, recorded it, set the receiver off, and went home. Again, this was a Saturday. Things tend to happen on Saturdays, because you spend all the week teaching in those days. And in the middle of the afternoon, I said to my daughter, that was spinning. That was spin rate that we were listening to. She said, aren't you going to tell Uncle Derek? I said, yeah, all right, I'll tell him. And I walked along the corridor to the phone, and as I put my hand out, before I could pick it up, it rang. I lifted the phone, and it was Derek, he said, that spin rate. We'd come to the same conclusion, almost simultaneously, sort of telepathically, if anything. So we got in the car, up to the school, put the thing onto the pen recorder, and found it was spinning at about 182 RPM. In fact, this is a recording of what it sounded like. This was pretty close. The nominal rate for Prospero was 200 RPM before launch, and when we were able to check with the Royal Aircraft Establishment on the Monday, in fact the spin rate was a little lower than had been expected. The reason why we were getting this throbbing was because the waxwing part of the Black Arrow rocket performed better than it should, didn't shut down, overtook the satellite, knocked one of the four antennae off. So there was a dip in the polar diagram. I said to my daughter, this will make a good project for one of the boys, because due to the Earth's magnetic field, eddy currents will be induced in the shell of the satellite, which will cause it to slow down. I said, they can check this for a year, and they'll be able to see the satellite spin decaying exponentially. She said, why can't I do that? I said, well, you can if you like. So at the age of 16, she started her project on the spin rate of the Prospero satellite. What she did was to go to the school every weekend, point the aerial by resting it on a laboratory stool in the direction at which the satellite would come above the horizon, make a recording for 2 minutes on the pen recorder, and then measure the number of throbs per minute. Over the year, this decreased. This is a recording of Prospero towards the end of 1 year. She used a programmable Casio desktop calculator to fit a straight line least squares curve to a semi-logarithmic plot of this, and indeed verified that the spin rate did decay exponentially. Now she's a physics teacher like her father, teaching at Malvern Girls College in England, one of the leading girls' independent schools, and she got a better degree than I did from my own university, and she has a receiver and she's picking up weather satellites in the afternoon periods when the girls have free activities. So just as with the physics teaching, where I've handed over my laboratory tricks to my daughter, the satellites are also carrying on the family business down in the West Country.
In 1984 you retired as a teacher, but your activities are continuing.
Yes, in 1976 they reorganised education in Northamptonshire on comprehensive lines, and our school, which had been founded by Queen Elizabeth I in 1577 as a grammar school, became a comprehensive school. This meant that instead of taking the top ability children of the area, we took a mixed ability range right the way through, and consequently the number of very able pupils declined in the school. I don't believe that this is the best way of educating children, and although I tried to make it work and did nothing to actively oppose it, I don't think I was very good when it came to teaching the children of the lower ability. So I decided that perhaps it was time that I moved on and made way for others to initiate progress. Having retired from teaching, I was able to devote myself full-time to my hobby of listening to satellites. The only trouble is, when you retire, people get the misconception that you've got plenty of spare time to be able to work for them. So Independent Television News said, "We would like to offer you an exclusive contract as a space consultant." I was very glad to accept that to top up the meagre teacher's pension that one gets in the United Kingdom. And then, at a later stage, I was asked by the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough if I would prepare the monthly supplements to their table of Earth satellites, again which I was happy to do. I've also had a chance to travel to Darmstadt in Germany at the invitation of the European Space Agency to take part in a symposium on the re-entry of space debris, in which we described our way of predicting the decay of Cosmos 1402. I've been to the United States, and I was lucky enough to see OSAT-1 launched on STS-51I in August 1985, although it very nearly crept into September and I very nearly missed my plane home. I went to Colorado Springs and was able to be briefed inside Cheyenne Mountain and repay it by briefing them briefly. I went to the Pugwash Conference, the 34th International Pugwash Conference on Science and World Affairs, in the Arctic Circle at Borkleden in Sweden. And now I'm here in Australia, starting out on an ambitious tour, taking in the majority of the state capitals, trying to pass on some of my enthusiasm to Australians, and hope that I can encourage school teachers in this country to form a passion for a project of their own and to enthuse and involve their kids, because the easiest way to educate a kid is not to let him know that he's being educated. If you say, "Come here, lad, sit down and I'll teach you scientific method," he'll say, "Over my dead body." But if you say, "Come and help me with my hobby and listen to the American astronauts," then he comes, and if he's loyal, he sticks. Over the years, the lads that have helped me have turned out to be good doctors, dentists, architects, computer systems programmers. We've even had some that have gone into the aerospace industry. But we didn't set out to turn out spacemen or astronauts. We tried to turn out educated, good scientists, and I hope that I have managed to do that.
Thank you very much, Jeff Berry.